The West Cork Literary Festival is offering a number of online events in lieu of a festival this year. Tonight, author Sinead Gleeson will be in conversation with essayist Leslie Jemison. Leslie has had notable success with her memoir, Come Cultural History, The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath, and her first essay collection, The Empathy Exam. Her latest work is Make It Scream, Make It Burn, a series of essays and long-form journalism, in large part meditations on isolation and longing. And I'm delighted to be speaking with Leslie Jemison ahead of an online event that she's doing at 8 o'clock this evening. Leslie, the essay itself, it strikes me, grown in popularity in the world of literature in recent time. Now, you managed to mix cultural history, memoir, reportage, literary criticism. There's a lot that goes into your essays. Did you happen upon this mix and gather of different ways of approaching writing?
Well, first of all, Sean, it's wonderful to be here. Wonderful to be talking to you. I've had such wonderful conversations with so many folks in Ireland about not just literature in general, but the essay in particular, which gets to your question, I think. Part of what I have always loved about the essay, and in a way I kind of don't understand why it hasn't always been more popular, why it's having its renaissance now, but hasn't always been in the middle of a renaissance. But I think for me, it's the ways in which the essay can bring together personal narrative, cultural history, literary criticism, really anything you want, biography, archival research, reportage. It's just an honest representation of what life itself feels like, right? Like, we're never segregating our personal lives and our encounters with the world. Like, when I encounter the world, I'm bringing all of my personal baggage to that encounter, and the essay is a form that can kind of hold all of that spillage.
So the essay has an ability to hold a number of different aspects and ways of approaching things that perhaps even fiction doesn't.
Fiction has its ways of holding them as well, and there's certainly tons of exciting fiction in the past decade that has actually become more essayistic in its willingness to sort of think explicitly on the page. But I know that for me, there's a way that the essay can be honest about the ways that all these modes of inquiry are connected. So when I'm researching the loneliest whale in the world, right, I'm bringing all of my own experiences with loneliness and all of my own thinking about loneliness, and the essay lets you be honest about that.
The Loneliest Whale in the World is such a wonderful story, because when I read the title, which it's the first essay in the book, actually, in the first section in the book, being called Longing, the others two being Looking and Dwelling, 52 Blue, and I thought, well, I wonder what this is about. explain who and what 52 Blue is.
So 52 Blue, also sometimes known as 52 Hertz, is a blue whale who has actually never been seen by human eyes, but he's been heard by this series of hydrophones on the ocean floor of the Pacific. And he's been heard. The reason he's become sort of famous is that he has a much higher pitched mating call than any other blue whale has ever been recorded as having, and that he's always been tracked alone, never in a pod of other whales. And so once the kind of data came out about 52 Blue, that he's named for his frequency, the frequency of his call, he became a bit notorious, because there was this sense that people developed that he had this really high-pitched mating call, that he was always alone, that he somehow couldn't find a mate, and a bit of a legend was born. And so I was interested not just in telling his story, but telling the story of folks who had become a little bit obsessed with him.
Yeah, I suppose it's important to point out, poor old 52 Blue, he's singing away to his heart's content. The other whales can't hear him at all. Is that biologically a fact?
It's not clear that no other whales can hear him, but maybe that his call isn't, they speculate that maybe the call isn't as appealing or isn't as legible to them as a more traditional frequency.
Somebody with a slightly lower frequency is more acceptable. So as is typical in many of the essays, Leslie, yeah, we think, is this about the whale? Yes, at one level it is. But of course it becomes about, as you mentioned to me, the people who in fact become interested in the whale. One of whom I have to go to practically immediately, because his name is David, and he's a father of two, an Irishman.
Yeah, he was one of many characters who I discovered in writing that piece. And David became interested in the whale, I think during a time of personal transition, and his interest only deepened as his life went through these radical ruptures. I think he was in the midst of a divorce and encountering, you know, his own forms of loneliness. And many of the people that I discovered felt spoken to by the whale when they were either trying to craft lives on their own or without romantic partnership or in the wake of a breakup. And the whale really had a way of becoming a kind of totem for those folks.
And what do you think that's, you know, your conclusion in the essay in some ways is it that these people projected their own desires, their own needs, their own personalities onto the whale? Is that ultimately what made 52 Blue so attractive to the various characters?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there was a ton of projection going on in the story of 52 Blue. But I think part of where I wanted to go with the essay is that necessarily a bad thing? Is that pathetic? Is it wrong? No, not necessarily. I think we take the world in and make it what we need it to be. And we don't need to forget that the whale is an actual whale with his own life and things about that life we probably can't even fathom. But, you know, do we find meaningful totems in the world and do they help us survive our own lives? Yeah, absolutely.
Another essay that really jumped out at me, and we can't get to all of them, obviously, in our conversation, "We Tell Ourselves Stories in Order to Live Again." This is a story of reincarnation, or a young boy who feels he might have lived previously as a fighter pilot or during World War II, at any rate, on an aircraft carrier. The obvious question here is, do you believe in reincarnation? Is this about finding out whether reincarnation exists or not? That's not where you bring us, though.
Ultimately, with that piece, I was more interested in the question of why people are drawn to these stories of reincarnation and how people use reincarnation or the idea of inhabiting prior lives that somehow stay with them, how that helps them make sense of their current lives, their current existence. So in the case of James Leininger,
who's the young boy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He had memories of having been a fighter pilot in a former life, a World War II fighter pilot, and that his parents sort of used those memories to make sense of the ways that James was afflicted by nightmares, some of the kind of social anxieties that he had. And to me, that felt like whether or not you believe in reincarnation, there's something really human in that attempt to make sense of things you can't quite understand or control about your daily experience, especially things that are difficult.
The other thing that really struck me in this essay is normally we would think, right, well, the writer here, the author, is going to be skeptical of the person who's telling this story. In fact, you become skeptical of those who are skeptical about the story itself. You're skeptical of the skeptics.
Yeah, that's probably a good thing for my tombstone, skeptical of the skeptics. I think that's a good description. I mean, I think I'm often interested in asking why we respond to things the way that we do. And I think resistance is one of the most powerful and telling responses we can have to the world. So whenever somebody is really hostile or resistant to a theory or very dismissive or condescending towards it, I'm always curious, like, where does that condescension come from? Like, what are you afraid to look at in yourself? What do you get out of looking down on this person or this idea?
Yeah, and that's precisely what you explore in the essay. The second part of the book is referred to, this section is called Looking, and lots of stuff about photography in here. In particular, the final essay in that section struck me, Maximum Exposure. Tell us a little bit about Annie Apple and her project to document the lives of a Mexican family over a period of 2 decades.
Annie Appel is an American photographer who lives just outside of Los Angeles and got to know a woman living in Mexico with her family by chance. And Annie was a photographer, and she had a kind of a moment of clarity or vision where she decided she wanted to photograph this woman, Maria, and her family for 10 years. And she decided to do that. And then 10 years became 15 years, became 20 years, became 25 years. Annie kept going back to visit Maria and her family as Maria's babies became parents. Everybody grew older. Everybody went through these life transformations. And so what Annie has produced over the years is this incredible archive that documents 25 years in an ordinary family's life. And obviously those years also span larger political and social changes around the militarization of the U.S. border. And but more than anything, I was really moved by Annie's obsession, the way that her obsession yielded this incredible document of human life.
But there is an aspect in this story. I mean, there's violence in the family. There are aspects where the family are in real trouble. And Annie kind of doesn't necessarily help. She goes with that old Star Trek prime directive thing, you don't interfere, which came a cropper, it has to be said, for Kevin Carter, the Pulitzer Prize winning photographer. Just tell us about his story and how it links in with Annie.
Mm-hmm. So I write a little bit about, and this is a great example of what we were talking about earlier, the permissions of the essay to let you bring various things in to explore the ideas that you're exploring. I talk a little bit about the story of Kevin Carter, who took that very famous photograph of a young African infant kind of crawling toward a supply station, and you can sort of see buzzards perched behind the baby. It's an incredibly disturbing photograph, and Kevin Carter won a Pulitzer Prize for it. It was a document of extreme poverty that you know really was known all over the world. And but Kevin Carter himself, I think, really struggled with what it meant to be documenting conditions of extreme suffering without being able to alleviate them. And a few years after he won the Pulitzer, he ended up taking his own life. And you know, it's too simple to say he took his own life because he was a photographer who couldn't save everybody he photographed. But at the same time, the encounter with human suffering was surely part of his psyche and part of his troubles.
And you're looking at that in the essay in particular, this whole idea of where exploitation and witnessing, where is there a dividing line, and where does one start and the other begin? What about the exploitation of your own life then, which is what you do in some ways in the final section of the book? A number of essays in there deal with your own personal experiences. You also said another point about the relationship between the artist and the subject can get messy and overwhelming. How difficult is it to write about your own life? Because some of it is difficult material.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly difficult in a craft sense, in a creative sense, and in an emotional sense to write about the most charged and difficult parts of your own experience. I write some about difficult relationships in my family, romantic relationships that have ended. You know, I'm plenty of sources of pain that are ordinary and common, but still painful. But I also believe that so much of the most meaningful material in our lives dwells in precisely those spaces that are most painful or that we're most ashamed of. And I sort of think, go big or go home, right? Like, why would you write about the things that don't move you? Why would you write about the things that don't feel almost impossible to articulate?
Well, and that's exactly what you do across the essays. Lovely to speak with you, Leslie. I'll let you go now because you do have to get that event. 8 o'clock, it's at?
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. It was lovely to speak to you today.
And lovely to speak with Leslie Jemison there as well. And if you want to join in on that conversation, Leslie Jemison in conversation with Sinead Gleeson begins at 8 p.m, a few seconds time. westcorkmusic.ie. Go to the Literary Festival part of that website and you can join in to the Leslie Jemison, Sinead Gleeson event. That's our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1.